there, everyone. This is Lori, and thank you for joining me on this recording. What I hope to talk about, we'll talk about today, is basically how a physical therapy assessment can augment veterinary diagnostics. So it's easy then with all of the rehab toys and tools, so the underwater treadmill and the hypoallergenic gel and the therapy balls and the laser and the electrodes, to misinterpret that rehab is all about the toys and all about the tools. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. I believe strongly, and have seen it in clinical practice, that which yields the greatest success in rehab is entirely dependent upon an accurate physical diagnosis. And this is exactly what the physical therapy profession and physical therapists have brought to the veterinary field. And that is providing ways to look at the body, the joints, the limbs, the spine, provide more manual assessment techniques, enhanced deductive reasoning skills, and evaluation of function. So if we look then at a traditional medical diagnosis and a traditional veterinary diagnosis, pardon me, this diagnostic perspective seeks an anatomical origin of the problem, and it relies on some clinical tests, but relies very heavily on diagnostic tests, and from my opinion, a little too heavily on diagnostic tests. So the primary goal is to name the lesion with the subsequent thought process of, how will I reduce the lesion? So what differs then from the physical therapy approach and the rehab approach is what we do is it creates a pathofunctional diagnosis. So this diagnostic perspective seeks not only the anatomical origination of the problem, but it also utilizes an assessment algorithm and cumulative results from multiple clinical tests, manual testing techniques. So it will also identify the functional impairment, interrelationships with other structures, repercussions of perhaps that lesion, and potential biomechanical origins of the lesion. So what maybe caused this problem in the first place? Thus, the subsequent goal or thought process is not only how to reduce the lesion, which may be by rehabilitation or by referral for surgery, but also how to improve function. And I think this is a key difference, is it's a functional assessment as compared to just a medical assessment, and looking a whole lot more at the manual testings and what information we can get from manual testing. So it's not just about what does the x-ray show me, but what are all of the pieces in this. So we have an example. Cash is a 12-year-old male neutered border collie lab cross, was referred to me with the diagnosis of decreased range of motion in hips due to arthritis secondary to dysplasia. And he had been having treatments at his vet clinic. They were using K laser, a class 4 laser on his hips. He was prescribed Cartrafin and Medicam, and he was on a joint diet food at that point in time. His activity level is very high, and this is the owners, you know, were and still are fabulous owners that really look at getting their dogs enough physical activity in the day. So he is actually getting off-leash time 3 times a day for a total of 1 to 1.5 hours a day. So essentially, subjectively, we know, or knew, still know, that Cash has hip dysplasia. Right was worse than the left, and basically hip dysplasia with quite severe arthritis. But 3 months ago, he began limping on the left front, and he had swelling on the toes of the left front as well. And essentially, the owners noted that when he would increase in play, it would cause dragging of his right hind leg. He was worse at the end of the day, and while Medicam did seem to help, essentially, it wasn't touching enough or to their satisfaction his front leg issues. So the owner was concerned about front leg issues. So now when I assessed Cash, what I found is he had crappy hip extension. So the right would only extend to 130. We know normal should be about 150. Left would go about 145. But in both cases, he had a hard end feel, okay, but he had no pain with this range of motion. It was just crappy. He had no pain with palpation of the pectineus. He had mild pain on palpation of the deep gluteal muscles. Okay, both of those techniques, if you have taken a course from me, you'll know that both of these I have found clinically over the years that a dog that has hip pain, clinical hip pain, tends to also have pain in the pectineus and pain of the deep gluteal muscles. So, Cash doesn't really show much. He's got crappy hips, but they're not really giving him pain, as per this assessment so far. He had no pain with palpation of his iliopsoas muscles, and he was tender on palpation of the sartorius on his right hind leg. His sacroiliac joints and lumbar spine, he had no tenderness there, but hard, bony end feel to test these movements, so what I would speculate to be some spondylosis in that region. If we look at his front legs, the left shoulder, elbows, and carpi bilaterally, there was full range of motion and no tenderness. The right shoulder, there was discomfort and apprehension at the end of range of motion, flexion, extension, and abduction. So things that make me go, this shoulder in general is not happy. There's some capsular irritation, I would say, based on that. He had discomfort with palpation of the teres major and latissimus dorsi, which now starts to make sense because he's likely trying to offload forwards because he's got these crappy hips that don't move very well. He doesn't get great propulsion from the back end. So he's likely pulling himself along. That's what that finding says to me. And bilaterally, his digits were thickened at the MCPs D2 to 5 and had discomfort to fully flex and extend these joints as well. So essentially looking at the rest of his spine, cervical spine, he had full range of motion, good mobility, no tenderness. Thoracic spine, he was very tender, T8 to T11, and the associated ribs, mild tenderness to T1 to T7. So when I see then that dogs have this tenderness T8 to T11, I tend to find that as a relatively common finding in some dogs, and especially dogs that are trying to offload a front end or a back end, and especially when it's associated with the ribs as well. That tends to tell me it's not so much of a dysfunction as in the joints are not moving right, but it tells me that he is compensating with this area of his body. So what I sent back to the vet, my pathofunctional diagnosis, is that I think the hip osteoarthritis and suspected fusion of the sacroiliac joints and lumbar spine are only causing mechanical issues, but minimal soft tissue or nervous system reactions, and that the painful areas seem to be the forepaw digits, right more than left, at the MCP joints. I suspect osteoarthritis there. T8 to T11 and associated ribs were painful. I suspect that's overuse. The right shoulder, with its pain with those three ranges of motion, I suspect some early signs of osteoarthritis in there. And the teres major latissimus dorsi pain, I suspected to be overuse, due to postural and movement compensation secondary to the hips and caudal spine. So essentially, let me go back to that one. Essentially, the diagnosis isn't just hip arthritis, which is what it was sent to me. He had dysplasia and hip arthritis, but it's looking at the whole body. And I have to do a good job in treating this dog, I have to address the whole body and figure out in what sequence I need to focus. So maybe I do a little bit on all things, but I focus primarily on certain areas. So this is a nice example of a pathofunctional diagnosis. In physical therapy, and what physical therapists bring is thinking outside the box to name the lesion. So there are several non-traditional sites and lesions that can result in lameness, poor movement, reduced athletic performance, and postural alterations. So some examples of muscles can be muscle strains, tendinopathies, muscle weakness, muscle shortening, muscle overactivity, and myofascial trigger points. And I've heard this said to me more than once, that in vet medicine we learn about the joints and the bones, and that squishy stuff is just that stuff you got to get through in order to get to the joints and the bones. But that squishy stuff is so important. So let's look a little more into this. So this is a synopsis of a paper that I presented at the 3rd International Symposium on Rehabilitation and Physical Therapy in Vet Medicine. Pardon me. And it was entitled Anatomy, Biomechanics, Physiology, Diagnosis, and Treatment of Teres Major Strains in the Canine. And essentially what I did is I went through, I'd seen a whole pile of dogs that were, basically, I found them to be painful and have a primary issue in their teres major muscle. So I went back retrospectively and looked through these cases and tried to put them together to see what I found. And of them, 14 were athletic dogs, five female, 9 male. They were somewhere between 2 and 10 years old. They were all referred to me with front limb lamenesses, and basically an open diagnosis. So it was, I don't know what's going on. Please help me. 8 of the 14 had x-rays that revealed normal shoulder joints. Veterinary treatment in all cases was a prescribed rest. In about half the cases, they were given non-steroidals. Onset of lameness varied from 2 days to 2 years. So some then that had been on and off lame for 2 years, and others then that, as I started educating more and more of the athletic dog owners, they started recognizing these symptoms and bringing them to me sooner. So I had some that were sent as early as 2 days. And essentially my physical exam showed pain to stretch and pain on palpation of the teres major muscle. 4 of them, of these dogs, had no other findings, and 10 had some secondary findings. Now, when we think about teres major, and we think about trying to look at any muscle for that aspect, but you need to think, what is the origin insertion? And based on the origin insertion, you're going to think about what is the action of that muscle, therefore, how can it become injured, and therefore, how will you assess for it? And then from a therapy standpoint, what will be your treatment goals? We need to take into account the principles for soft tissue healing and look at how will you plan to stage the return to activity. So these were all athletic dogs. So I can't just say, okay, that's great, they're no longer lame. Nuh-uh. I got to take them back to full competition. So I've got to go above and beyond what one would normally look at as, yep, dog's no longer lame, yay, I did a great job. I got to get them back to competition. So if we look here, this slide shows, here's our teres major muscle. It is on the medial side of the shoulder joint, going from that caudal angle of the scapula to the proximal one-third of the medial aspect of the humerus. It joins together with latissimus dorsi, and they form a common insertion point. It's going to be injured with activities that involve run, 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 plant, and turn. So the dog is then turning suddenly, or it might be in the case of agility, they go over a jump or they do some obstacle and they have to do a turn, a 180 to go the opposite direction, and that can cause problems in their, that can cause a strain or a slip or anything like that. It might be overuse, it might be a slipping that occurs. I'm going to look at how to stretch this. Okay, I'm going to stretch this muscle. If I know the action of it is to flex the shoulder, adduct the shoulder. Oh, yes, flex the shoulder, adduct the shoulder, and adduct, internally rotate and adduct. Sorry, let me get that again. It's going to flex the shoulder, internally rotate, and adduct. Therefore, one of my assessments is going to be to stretch it, and my treatment will also be to stretch it. And that's going to be taking the front limb into the shoulder, into extension, abduction, and external rotation. And then where I'm going to look at palpating for teres major is going to be up high in the caudal aspect of the axilla. Okay? And bearing in mind, looking at the origin insertion, so where that muscle is and how it lies, and getting your fingertips up and onto that, and you're essentially just poking your fingertips or ramming your fingertips into that teres major muscle to assess for a reaction. And dogs that have pulled that muscle, it's just a yelp of absolute pain when you hit that. So that tends to be how I'll look at that. And this was something that I had never read in any other papers. I had never seen it. I hadn't thought about teres major, but the first dogs that started coming to me, I thought, you know, I looked at them from stem to stern and nothing added up with their lameness. I got out my anatomy book and started to think, what am I missing here? And that's when, fortunately, I looked at that muscle and thought, I wonder how I would palpate for it, how to test for it, and lo and behold, boom, I started finding tons of these dogs. So this is another example of physical therapists helping the veterinary profession to make alternate diagnosis, naming the lesion. So if we look then at muscle weakness as a potential pathology, we recognize that muscle weakness can result in reduced joint cushioning. So if you don't have strong enough quadriceps or hamstring muscles, it can impact stifle arthritis, for example, that if we don't have proper cushioning, it can cause more problems to the stifle joint. So it's not just that, yes, my dog's stifle has arthritis, but what else can be contributing, or why is this becoming a problem now? And maybe it's muscle weakness. Muscle weakness can cause improper biomechanics. So you might have weak abdominal muscles that are leading to lumbosacral pain and dysfunction, because if your abdominals are not helping to hold that spine, the bowstring construct, they call it, helping to hold that spine, then it's just going to allow it to sag into extension and cause those facet joints to jam, and extend, and crash down on each other. And that can cause pain in the spine. So perhaps then the root of the back pain is weak abdominals. We need to know to look for that. And weak muscles can also lead to abnormal joint development. And this is a possible rationale for why you might have a puppy, that develops unilateral hip dysplasia. So perhaps there's been some issue, maybe there's been a sacroiliac joint dysfunction, some problem then that causes atrophy or causes a reduction in the proper utilization and the strength of the gluteal muscle that can then lead to abnormal biomechanics and abnormal development of the hip joints. So total theory, but I always wonder why would you have unilateral hip dysplasia if it's genetic? So I throw that out there. So how are we going to treat for a muscle weakness? It can't just be any old exercise. Oh, here, do this, run up and down a hill, jump on this, go swimming. Your exercises have to be very specific and targeted in order to see improvement. So you need to find these muscle weaknesses in order to specifically address those muscle weaknesses. Very important. We can also look at myofascial trigger points, and this is certainly something that's coming up more and more as something of interest in veterinary medicine, because there are some vets that have gone about and learnt a good deal more about myofascial trigger points by taking human courses in them and then looking at applying it to the dog. So, myofascial trigger point is described as a hyper-irritable spot in skeletal muscle that is associated with a hypersensitive palpable nodule in a taut band. The spot is tender when pressed and can give rise to characteristic referred pain, motor dysfunction, and even an autonomic phenomena. And what we look at on diagrams is basically just that. It looks like a contraction knot. It looks like a little nodule or little blip, and that's what it feels like. It feels like a tight band when you palpate the muscle. And oftentimes, if you're going along a muscle and the animal's going, oh yeah, oh, that hurts, I would say the best place to find one on yourself is right there at your shoulders and your trapezius muscle. Everybody's got knots there, or between your shoulder blades. Those would be trigger points. So the thoughts on how a trigger point would develop, it could be persistent low-level muscle contractions, so Cinderella theory, and that it's always working. Could be uneven intramuscular pressure distribution, might actually be due to direct trauma, or it could be unaccustomed eccentric contractions in an unconditioned muscle. and or with maximal or submaximal concentric contractions. So there's lots of theories out there as to why these might develop. So I have a case that looks at myofascial trigger points. So this particular case, Trace, is a 5-year-old spayed female flat-coated retriever. And she was referred with the diagnosis of progressive hind limb lameness with questionable osteoarthritis, and she also had patella alta. And so treatments to date, she had been getting Medicam as needed. The owner had her on a human brand of glucosamine, and her activity level was long walks that were 45 minutes to 1 hour a day, and chasing balls and swimming in the river. The diagnostic tests she'd had were x-rays of the spine, hip, and stifles, and so you could see on x-ray that she had patella alta indeed. The owner subjectively reported that she was running a little odd, quote-unquote, for the last 3 months, and the surgical consult determined that she had this patella alta, and the owner was offered surgery to lengthen the sartorius muscle. The owner thought, wow, that sounds a little bit drastic for a dog that's just a little off, and we had treated a previous dog of hers, so she asked to be referred to our rehab clinic to get a second opinion on things that might be done for her dog. So when we looked at her dog, our pathofunctional assessment findings, we found when we looked at posture and limb, she was definitely favoring the one leg, so she had reduced weight bearing on the right hind leg and stance. Proximal thigh circumference, she had about a 1.5 centimeter difference, so the right hind leg proximal thigh circumference about 1.5 centimeters difference. Flexion of the stifles with her hips in extension, which if you've taken the courses, the rehab courses, will recognize that is how you would stretch sartorius. On the left, she could flex to 105 degrees. On the right, she could only flex to 130 degrees, thus meaning she had less flexion, or the knee remained straighter. She had coarse crepitus at the patellofemoral joints with stifle range of motion. This was bilaterally. But the right sartorius was very tender on palpation, and very tight as well when we tried to stretch it, and even when we just palpated, it felt tighter than the other side. She had some secondary issues as well, so she had a left sacroiliac joint dysfunction and moderate tenderness of teres major bilaterally. So left SI joint, but it was the right we're finding problems in, so that doesn't quite add up. And the tenderness of teres major, again, I'm going to say she is offloading the whole hind end and she's pulling herself forwards. So what I reported back, so the pathofunctional diagnosis was myofascial trigger points and tightness of the right sartorius, and that this may be causing additional compressive forces at the patellofemoral joints and the subsequent crepitus. So essentially, we treated this. We did a little bit of laser. We did dry needling of the trigger points. We did stretches, and treating the trigger points alone resolved this patient's signs completely, so she was walking and moving normally thereafter. And I have to be totally honest that this, I always look at trigger points as being secondary to something else, but this case was one that showed me that sometimes your trigger points might actually be the primary problem as well. So it's certainly a good thing to keep in the back of your mind. So more things to think about when we're looking at our diagnoses and different thinking outside the box to name the lesion would be axial skeleton dysfunction. So things that might affect the skull, so for example the TMJ joint, the spine, the ribs, the pelvis, that being the sacroiliac joint. And looking then at dysfunction, and what the heck do I mean by dysfunction? And this is a physiotherapy term that implies that a joint is not moving appropriately and is either termed as hypomobile, not moving enough, or hypermobile, moving too much. Signs of a axial skeleton dysfunction could be localized pain on palpation. We know from people that it can sometimes radiate pain down a limb, and so we may have a dog that shows lameness or gait abnormalities as well. And certainly this can cause reduced athletic performance and reduced functional performance as well. So here's an example. This is a 2-year-old, or Ursula, is a 2-year-old female intact Borzoi. And her referring diagnosis was essentially no significant findings at time of exam. 1 week history of yelping when getting up from lying, and further diagnostics were declined by the owner. So this is, she presented to me with just that. Treatments to date, the owner had simply reduced her activity level. In general, prior to the reduced activity level, the owner says, oh, she plays with other dogs and she's very hard on her body. So Borzois do tend to, you know, run and crash into each other and bash. And yeah, they're not so bright when it comes to self-preservation in that regard. So the pathofunctional assessment that we did on Ursula, we looked at her posture and gait. We saw there's no lameness and no offloading of any limb at the point in time she came in to see me. Looking at her extremity joints and soft tissue, she had full range of motion and no tenderness on palpation throughout the forelimbs, full range of motion and no tenderness on palpation of digits, tarsi, and stifles. What I did find in her hips was pain on deep palpation of the iliopsoas muscles bilaterally. And this I find clinically significant in that if it's unilateral, I tend to think, well, that could be a strain. But bilateral, that's not a, unless you have a history where a dog has had some sort of a terrible accident, both legs got caught up and on behind them, it doesn't make sense that a dog would strain the iliopsoas muscles bilaterally. So if I found pain on bilateral pain on deep palpation of the iliopsoas muscles, I'm going to think a couple things. One is that the dog is overusing them or compensating and holding itself in a contracted position to offload front or back, but she didn't look that way on examination of her posture. Or she's got back pain. And your iliopsoas muscle, we have to recognize, iliopsoas muscle goes as high as T9-10. Psoas minor goes up as high as T9-10. Psoas major, then, goes up as high, you know, originating from the ventral surface of the vertebrae. So psoas major goes up as high as the lumbar spine and comes down, and then they join with iliacus there, the pelvis, and insert at the lesser trochanter of the hip. So any kind of back pain, and especially something that causes a nerve irritation, so be it disc, be it a pinched nerve, an osteophyte potentially, this can irritate the nerve endings and then create those nerves to be hyperexcited, and they send off exaggerated signaling to some of the muscles that they supply, and often the muscles that are closest to them. So iliopsoas, so psoas major, psoas minor, fit that category. So already I'm thinking she's compensating for something else, or this is going to be a sign of back pain in this case. So when we get to the spine, her cervical spine and her thoracic spine, good mobility, no tenderness. Her lumbar spine, she was very tender at L7. She had atrophy and hypotonicity of the epaxials and multifidus muscles adjacent to the L6 to S1 region. And she had pain when I attempted to close down the left facet of L7 S1. So basically, if you can visualize or see a picture of a spine and the lumbosacral junction, you would be able to, through maneuvering the dog and pushing on the vertebrae in certain ways, be able to cause more extension of one facet relative to the other, or closing down. So when I closed down left facet L7 S1, there was more pain. So I'm thinking we've got something L7 S1 that is irritating, pinching a nerve, is my best guess at this point. Pelvis, she had bilateral tenderness over the sacroiliac joint and the piriformis muscles, both sides, and the right ilium was positioned cranially. So I think she had some sort of a sacroiliac joint dysfunction as well. So essentially, her pathofunctional diagnosis, L7 S1 nerve root impingement, acute on chronic. What I don't impin here is likely also a sacroiliac joint dysfunction. And what was interesting then, so this isn't necessarily delving into how I treated it, but essentially how we found it. What was interesting as well, when she got up to leave, she yelped. And I palpated that region immediately thereafter, and there was a change in muscle tone instantly. So she had, now she got a little bit of a spasm of that region, and so she had a hypertonicity for a period of time there, which also helps to confirm my diagnosis, in that if the muscle tone changed instantly like that, that tells us then that there's an instant irritation to the nerve, the supply, all of that going on. Usually when there's atrophy, it tells you that it's chronic, it's been going on for a long time. And when you get a sudden change, it tells you that it's more acute. So we have acute on chronic, I would say, is what this is telling me. Okay. So if we start looking at a physical therapy assessment algorithm, okay, and where as a physical therapist, how I have been taught to assess. So we would go through a scanning exam, and a scanning exam means that you're looking at the whole of the animal. So you would first off taking history, we're observing the animal. We would do a scanning exam looking at the spine, cervical, or lumbar in particular, thoracic as well, but even if you're looking at a front, if you're looking at a front leg, you've got to assess the cervical spine and upper thoracic. If you're looking at a lumbar, or sorry, a rear leg problem, you need to definitely put lumbar spine into that, and I would throw pelvis too. We want to look then at the spine. We've got to do active movements, passive movements if we can. Normally in a human, we would also do resisted isometric contractions, which we can't really do in the dog. We can't ask them to hold that position and don't let me push you. But that would be our thought processing generally from humans. We would then go to the peripheral joints. We would do active range of motion, passive range of motion, perhaps some resisted testings there as well. And then throwing in some new concepts to consider in what we would look at as far as a neurologic screen as well, would be looking at myotomes. Does there seem to be a weakness of certain muscle groups that are supplied by particular nerve roots? And are there any sensory issues or dermatome issues that we would look at? So areas of skin sensation that is altered, or perception is altered in certain areas that are supplied by certain nerve roots as well. And I would throw in here, we know this on the veterinary side as well. There was a study done, Stisetol, it was the mid-90s in veterinary dermatology, and they looked at lick granulomas and found that about 56% of lick granulomas also had a reduced nerve conduction. So basically saying that, or what, let me interpret that for you, is basically that the reason that the animal was licking and chewing at a spot could very well have been that they had abnormal sensation in that area due to a pinched nerve or something essentially that was causing a nerve conduction issue. So that we can make that step, we can make that conclusion then from what we know in humans causing abnormal sensory to the dogs, because it's also been shown, and to start looking and adding that into our testing and our thought processing, our deductive reasoning. And of course, even if everything looks ortho, smells ortho, tastes ortho, you need to do some neuro tests just to see whether there might be a neurologic component as well. From your scan, you're going to make your educated guess to whether this problem is primarily spinal or peripheral, or oftentimes both. And so if you go to the spine, you need to do your special test for the spine. You would look at reflexes. You would look at joint play, and I'll talk about that more. Palpation, and is there need for further diagnostics? When we're looking at the peripheral joints, we're going to then go more into our active movements, our passive movements, okay, and trying to look at passively taking things to their anatomical end range. We could also look at resisted movements. There will be special tests that you can do. You're familiar with these anyways, but there's maybe some more that physical therapy is adding to the veterinary side. Again, looking at reflexes, joint play, palpation, and deciding do we need further diagnostics here as well. So some of these new concepts and considerations. One is a myotome. So I brought this up. It's a muscle or muscle group supplied primarily by one nerve root, whereas a dermatome refers to an area of skin whereby sensation is supplied by one nerve root. Ah, there we go. And so basically bringing up that paper again that looked at the correlation between like granulomas and nerve conduction. So certainly to look and find a dermatomal chart that can help you look at, okay, if the dog is licking on the inside of its forearm just below the elbow, that could be C7, and you need to get your hands on C7 and test C7. So just a thought process. We need to also recognize that passive movement is not just range of motion, but also the evaluation of the quality of the movement. So the quality is going to be important as well when we're looking at our range of motion. Passive movement does not only pertain to joint range of motion, but some cases to the extensibility of soft tissues as well. So it might be muscle stretching for your diagnostic purposes. And what you need to look at is knowing your origins, insertions, and actions to know how to stretch specific muscles. So looking at whether your muscle is a one-joint muscle or a two-joint muscle. So if we flex the shoulder, we know that we're not just testing shoulder flexion. We are also stretching supraspinatus. And then we would look at if I wanted to stretch sartorius. That's a two-joint muscle. So I need to extend the hip and flex the stifle to be specific about sartorius. So this is going to be important. We're also going to look at capsular pattern and recognizing this is something, it's a human term again. And in the physical therapy side, we recognize, or we've defined a capsular pattern. So this is a capsular pattern of restriction. Of restriction is important. Occurs when a lesion is of the joint capsule or when a total joint reaction is present that affects the joint capsule, such as in osteoarthritis. What we recognize in the human field is that by looking at capsular patterns and our manual testing techniques, that physical therapists are able to detect signs and symptoms of osteoarthritis before they would become radiographically evident. Okay, so this is going to be important in looking at that. Now, while capsular patterns are not yet identified in the canine, or rather in any animal species, we can look at what we find clinically and certainly start making our educated guess as to what they would be. So a non-capsular pattern then may indicate other restrictive lesions, so ligamentous adhesions, internal derangement, or extra-articular lesions. So if let's use an example then that vets would all recognize. If you look at a dog with arthritic hips or hip dysplasia, painful hip dysplasia, you know then that you would expect that dog to have pain with hip extension. Some of you may have actually tested, and I know if I've taught you, you're looking for it now, that they'd also likely have pain and restriction with internal rotation of the hips. So loss of extension and or internal rotation accompanied by pain often would be the capsular pattern for the canine hip. So if you had a dog that had pain with hip flexion, you don't see that very often, you would know that there's something else going on. That's a non-capsular pattern. So there's got to be something else going on other than just a straightforward arthritic hip. So that's an example of utilization of capsular pattern knowledge. Physical therapists will also look at joint play. And this is the evaluation of the joint and all of its movement. Okay, so looking at the physiologic movements, that just would basically mean how they would, let's say, in the case of a knee, flex or extend, okay, but also looking at the accessory movements. So in our knee or our stifle, I might also look at the cranial and caudal glides. I might also look at medial and lateral glides. Let's say if I'm evaluating a dog's neck, I might do a side glide and add a bit of a rotation component onto it. Okay? And when I'm looking at the joint play or the mobility within a joint, I am assessing it at end range. And end range tells me what's stopping this movement and the overall mobility and end abilities, I guess, of that joint. But I also want to look at it in neutral, which tells me just how tight or loose this joint is as a general rule. If we then take this further and look at joint play and taking it to the end feel. So I talked about feeling joint play at the end of a range and in neutral. But if I take it to the end of the range, so an end feel is exactly what it sounds like. It is the feel, the sensation in the tester's hand at the end of the motion. And it can be used to identify the tissue that is limiting further motion. So we can have hard capsular. This would be the sensation when you test an intact cruciate. That's hard capsular end feel. It can be a bony end feel. That would be the normal sensation of elbow extension. It can be an elastic end feel. Elastic end feel is when you try to flex the tarsus on a dog and the Achilles tendon, the calcaneal tendon is stretched. That's elastic. Soft capsular would be carpus flexion. Soft tissue opposition would be stifle flexion. And then you're going to get into some others that you don't feel much on a normal basis. So you would have a springy end feel, and this might be the sensation if you close down on a deranged meniscus. So if you close down, there's a meniscus tear, and you try to extend the stifle, and you kind of get that boing, boing, usually with pain. But if you ignore the pain that the animal's having and just concentrate on what your hands feel. And I don't mean ignore the pain as in just push through the dog's pain. I mean feel what your hands are feeling. You acknowledge the pain, but you feel what your hands are feeling and concentrate on that. You can sometimes feel that spring back of the meniscus, kind of that extra blip of meniscus in there bouncing on itself. You might have spasm. So if you try to move, and you can get a spasm if you're trying to put a joint into a range that's painful, or if you are trying to stretch a muscle that has a tear. Okay, and then you would also have an empty end feel. An empty end feel means you feel nothing, but the animal is crying in pain, but you're not at the end. You feel no resistance within the tissue that you're moving. That can be an empty end feel. So within this talk, I don't have enough time to go into all of these different times and when things are normal and abnormal, when you would find them. But essentially, we know that there are certain structures that are stopping joints from moving. You know when it should be a hard capsular end feel. And so let's say if you do wrist flexion and you get hard capsular instead of soft capsular, that is clinically significant. Okay, or you get a bony sensation. If you try, think about when you push down in a dog's spine, in this lumbar spine, and you don't get give, you get that bony sensation. That could lead you to suspect that there's spondylosis in the spine. So there can be times when the end feels within a particular joint are normal, or when they're abnormal, or if they're normal but they come on too early. So let's say stifle extension in a dog that's had cruciate surgery or not, and you go to extend that stifle, and it doesn't go to the full range of motion, but you still get a hard end feel. So that's early capsular pattern for stifle extension. So that's still clinically significant. So this is where our end feels come into play. So here's an example. So here's Thunder, and Thunder's a 10-year-old male neutered border collie, and was referring diagnosis, unsure of the cause of lameness, thinks it's in the shoulder. So subjectively, the owner tells me, well, he's not moving or jumping well for the last few months, so he competes in agility. But in the last week, he's become lame in the right front leg. So essentially, my findings of the right shoulder, he had pain on end range flexion and extension of pure glenohumeral joint, recognizing that there's different ways to extend the shoulder. We can do extend the shoulder and allow the scapula to move, and that's going to stretch different muscles, or we can extend the shoulder, block the scapula from moving, and get pure glenohumeral extension. So that was painful. And his abduction, but he had normal range for a border collie. He had pain at the, which means he's got a lot, sorry. He had pain at the end range for abduction, but again, it was normal for a border collie as well. So he had a lot of abduction, most border collies do, but it was pain at the end, and it was, and essentially the range of motion was comparable on both sides. When I went to look at the shoulder a little bit closer, he had pain at the end of each glide. So when I glide, and this is our joint play, so apologize now, there's a lot of terms we throw out there that mean the same thing. So joint play and glides are kind of the same thing. So when I tried to glide the humerus cranially, when I tried to glide caudally, when I tried to glide it medially, there was pain with each of those. Now what I'm testing when I do that is the joint capsule. Testing some, to a certain extent, integrity of the joint surfaces, but I'm also stretching the joint capsule at the end of each of those. When I took it laterally, it was okay, and he had a hard capsular end feel on both of those. So I'm not getting a spasm, so I'm not thinking intra-articular issues. So I am thinking that there's some capsule irritation. So the additional findings, supporting an additional finding, that there was mild discomfort to palpation at the supraspinatus tendon, there was no pain on palpation or stretch of the biceps or caudal shoulder muscles, there was no pain on palpation of the medial joint line, no pain on palpation of the proximal humerus. So essentially with these, I'm ruling out he's got a little bit of supraspinatus issue, he does not have biceps issue, he does not have subscapularis or medial shoulder instability, no pain on palpation of the proximal humerus, so I'm, you know, because he's 10, he's a border collie, but whatever, so I'm thinking, looking for an osteosarc there. No pain with compression testing of the glenohumeral joint, which would be looking for something like an OCD lesion or osteoarthritis. And he had mild discomfort to deep palpation on the cranial and the medial sides of the right elbow joint, so he's got a little bit of elbow stuff going on there as well. So my assessment, my pathofunctional diagnosis was that he had acute on chronic flare of early shoulder osteoarthritis. And the subsequent radiographs, the vet decided that that he confirmed that there was some early signs of osteoarthritis. Now, I'm no radiologist, but I don't know, the shoulders looked not too bad to me, but it doesn't much matter because clinically he's got a flare, he's got irritation of the joint capsule, which most likely leads us to the thought process of an early osteoarthritic changes. Okay, so then a couple other new concepts and considerations. One would be resisted contraction. So we know that injured muscles or tendons are painful when they contract. Special tests incorporating, we can incorporate human tests, but these are not yet utilized in vet medicine. So there are tests that we use in the humans routinely that look for stifle meniscus that can be used in the dog as well. So the McMurray's test can be used in the stifle meniscus. We can use joint compressions to look for OCD lesions and meniscal tears. We can thought process through biomechanics, so do a biomechanic analysis to create pressure tests for the medial coronoid or anconeal processes in the elbow. And in humans, we utilize a 3 out of 5 rule, 3 out of 5 testing rule, that if you do 5 tests for sacroiliac joint dysfunction and 3 of them are positive, that you have a pretty good, you can be safe to assume that or to diagnose the problem being a sacroiliac joint problem. So these are all things from the human side that we're helping the vet side to look at and recognize to help with the diagnostics. And as well, looking at reflexes, utilizing myotomal distributions. So recognizing that doing reflexive muscle testing for particular muscle groups supplied by specific nerves can also be utilized. When we're doing palpation, the physical therapy side of things, we can be very, very specific, okay? And so you can be specific about palpating over bony landmarks. You can be specific about identifying differences between the tenosynovial junction and the musculotendinous junction for tendon and muscle. And also looking at detecting abnormal muscle tone in the muscle joints. And these can be very useful in helping with our clinical reasoning and our diagnoses. So essentially, when you're putting it all together, you're looking at the cumulative result of all of the physical tests and subjective history to help you create this pathofunctional diagnosis. And I think this is hugely important in the animal side, is to start looking then at the whole of the animal, the animal's whole being, to create this path of functional diagnosis. Good. So I know now I've given you plenty to chew on, and I want veterinarians to think of physiotherapy and animal rehab as being able to provide a second opinion, and to think of rehab and physio as being an augment to veterinary medicine, both from a diagnostic standpoint as well as the treatment. And think then of PTs practicing animal rehab as allied healthcare professionals that you can learn from, that we are both out there to benefit the client, to benefit the patient, sorry, and that we can certainly learn from each other. There's so much to be gained from learning from each other. Good, so that is it. Lots to think about. My slide here, I know you're listening on audio, can't see my slide. Tack for un utmark Samhet, which I can't pronounce properly, but that's thanks for listening in Swedish. So, thanks for listening, and goodbye.